My name is Angus McLean. My wife noticed yesterday in the Salmon Arm Shopper's Guide that you were seeking information on the airport, more specifically, I guess, connected with the part the Air Force played on the Smithers Airport. I can supply you with some information, but mainly connected with the actual airport itself. Incidentally, I was the little boy in a picture with his parents you were seeking identification of a year or two ago. I think you did find out through someone else, and I think I sent a letter too telling you who the family was. So it gives you some idea who I am. I went to school at the time, people like Herb Leach, Jack Chapman, Joe and Wilf Watson, etc., were going to school. That puts me in their age bracket since I was born in Hazleton in 1916. I am putting this down on tape since I am now completely blind and prefer this method of communication much easier than trying to type when you don't know you've made mistakes. Therefore, I shall put down whatever I can recall about those days. I had been mining in Headley in 1941 and went back to Smithers in July of that year, as I was expecting to join the armed forces. Went back to Smithers for a holiday. I'd only been back home a short time when early August I heard that an engineer had arrived to start building the airport, the runways, runway and taxiways, etc., and was looking for survey help. I had had some experience in surveying and saw the engineer. He was an old-timer who had come out of retirement. His name was R.S.B. Lillico. And he, as I say, came out of retirement and to do this job. So I went to work for him right away, and first on the ground as helping in the survey, as there was no clearing had been done or layout done. And then I was in the office for some time doing all the grade calculations, figuring quantities. Then I was promoted to instrument man, doing most of the survey work for a number of years. I ended up acting resident engineer back in 43-44. Work on the runway and taxiway started in early August of 1941. Clearing began almost immediately as Campbell Brothers Contracting from Vancouver were in there with their tractors ready to start clearing brush. So we had our work cut out for us to keep ahead of the contractors. Then the prime contractor came in. It was Carter, Halls, Aldinger. That's the name of three different men of the head of the firm. They came from Winnipeg. They did all the main work, supervised. The dirt moving and grading was done by Winnipeg Cartage Company, and the drainage done by Nelson River Dredging, I think it was. I mention these companies because they brought in pretty well all their own men, men experienced in heavy equipment operation and experienced in building airports, airfield runways, as they've been doing it for the air training scheme on the prairie. Therefore, these machine operators are quite skilled and could grade very accurately with their machines. These people did not hire very many from the local ranks of unemployed, because, as I say, they needed skilled men, skilled operators. Therefore, it was laborers mainly that were hired. These men were used on the fencing, digging manholes, general odds and ends work. There weren't too many needed. Quite a lot of grading was done in 41, despite rain almost every day, that is at least a light shower, which turn the glacial till soil into mud at times. In early 1942, we had instructions to widen the runway 50 feet to 200 feet, to put in a taxiway and parking apron for the Air Force planes. That meant changes in our plans and more work. At this time, the Air Force, I think, had started to put up their buildings, and that work, I think, was done by outsiders. People, some of the contractors, I think, coming from the Maritimes. Carl Spicer, who later stayed in Smithers, he is the one you should talk to about the Air Force days. And I guess the Volvo brothers and Ernie Han also worked as carpenters there. Otherwise, people were brought in. The Air Force put up a number of standard H-shaped buildings, two-story for accommodation, an office building, fire hall, I believe, a garage. They put in the sewer system and water supply taken from the lake. The Department of Transport, that is our part of it, we hooked in our buildings to their water supply and their sewer system later on. I don't think the Air Force had any real plans for having a staff or having aircraft permanently the duration of the war at Smithers, but I was talking to an Air Force officer and he told us they moved the squadron of Ventura bombers and Hurricanes from Terrace for a period of time because the weather was so bad in Terrace that they flew one day in 6 weeks. It wasn't very good. Also, with so many mountains around, they weren't too happy about flying conditions, especially when they were poor. It was a pretty hazardous operation around Terrace. So that's how the aircraft came to Smithers for a while, because of Terrace weather. Also, I think if they had operated too steadily out of Smithers with the bombers, even though they were light, that pavement design was too light for the aircraft, and there was some rutting, shallow rutting, because in those days there was no scientific design of pavement such as we have these days, when pavements are designed according to the soil type underneath and according to the wheel loadings to be placed on the pavement. Smithers called for 6 inches of gravel, wasn't even crushed gravel, and a 2-inch road mix, which also could be called a mix-in-place, plus a seal coat. The mix-in-place pavement was not a strong pavement, rather soft, and not meant for any heavy loads. Later on in 1955-56, the Department of Transport strengthened the Smithers runway, adding on from 24 inches to 30 inches of gravel, plus 2.5 inches of hot mix pavement to carry heavier aircraft. As I recall, the Air Force did not do too much flying out of Smithers. They did operate their staging route, as they called it. I think there were 2 flights a week. I traveled on several of their flights myself. One was made by a DC-3 aircraft. No seats in it. You sat on the floor. And also the other one was a Lockheed 18, I think. Once again, no seats. And the people traveling were either Air Force, occasional Army person, or we in the Department of Transport, engineering, or radio operators were permitted to ride to Vancouver on the aircraft. You were wanting to know what effect the airport had on the economy, I guess, and general conditions around Smithers at that time, and I guess after that. I think one of the few success stories would be Heggie's Cafe. Dick Heggie was a trucker, came in during the runway construction from Winnipeg or the Prairie somewhere. He may have had more than one truck himself. But after he finished work on the airport, he and his wife opened the cafe. As I recall, it was about the busiest place in town because dining places were at a premium. There weren't very many, and they weren't very good. Accommodation was at a premium too, because there was only really the Bulkley Hotel, the Hudson Hotel, the Cray House, and a few flop houses down in what was known as Chinatown. And I think nearly everything was full with these temporary workers coming in for the summer and then leaving when winter came. I think just about every shack in town was occupied. There were even stories about some chicken houses. Even some of the summer cottages around the lake were occupied. Some of them in winter, I believe, they would be pretty chilly. But there was nothing else, so people took what they could get. I do not recall what they had to pay for them, but at least it was a roof over their heads. I believe George Adamite, A-D-A-M-O-I-T, I think it is, was a carpenter who came in during the construction of the Air Force buildings. I don't know if he's still around. If he is, he could give you information. And as I mentioned before, Carl Spicer, who worked for the contractor, I guess, on the Air Force buildings, he was in the office. He should have a lot of knowledge on what happened to people and to the projects. Carl and George are about the only two people I can recall that stayed after the war and carried on in Smithers, having married local girls, I believe. Reflecting back, I would say that construction of the airport by the Department of Transport and its contractors, construction of the Air Force buildings and their use temporarily, and then they were torn down, that provided only temporary benefits to the community, the general area, that the real benefit, permanent benefit, has been since airlines started operating, commercial plane operators and private plane operators have provided the more enduring and permanent benefits to the community and surrounding area. I have a little story which perhaps should be preserved somewhere, I don't know just where, about the North and about old-time hockey players. In the winter of 1941-42, our resident engineer John Lillico was transferred to Prince George, and another veteran engineer, Bill Kilgour, that's K-I-L-G-O-U-R, was appointed resident engineer at Smithers, and I was doing all the survey work under him. In late spring, I think it was, or early summer, there was a phone call from Vancouver saying that they were going to build a landing strip at Woodcock, just a strip, just a runway, no taxiways, no apron. It was to be an emergency strip for terrorists. But what had happened, the contractor, Dutton Brothers, D-U-T-T-O-N, Brothers of Calgary, had arrived in Woodcock already with a whole train load of equipment. But there was no Department of Transport engineer there with the work, laying out the work for them. So there was a call from Vancouver, urgent call to Bill Kilgour, saying to get down to Woodcock, make the preliminary survey, and set some grades for this contractor who was rare to go. So Bill went down there and went right to work. He told us that he got there, one of the Dutton brothers was the superintendent, and this brother was the famous Red Dutton, a great, great hockey player in the major leagues a few years before, and he was rarer to go, just like in his hockey playing days. So, speed up the work. Once center line was established, it's usual to take levels on a perhaps 100-foot grid, which means a lot of leveling work. And normally, a rodman chainman would walk between the stakes and hold his rod up for the instrument man to sight on the rod and read it. Well, to move things along, this Red Dutton, the old hockey player, took the rod himself, and he ran between the stakes, and he hurdled any fence he came to. It was on a farm, Billy Little's farm in Woodcock. As a result, they had the leveling done in no time, and then Bill could plot up the information on paper and design the grades. So he had to stay there for a while, as no other engineer came to take his place for a while. And one day, I was at Smithers just with two men then, and things were going full blast, equipment everywhere. We had it under control. I had a phone call from Bill Kilgore saying, asking if I could line up a bottle of whiskey for them, that they'd be up to get it. They needed a drink. They'd been working too hard. So I managed to get a bottle of whiskey. And lo and behold, Red Dutton and Bill Kilgore arrived on a CNR speeder. Somehow they commandeered it and a man to run it. They chugged into the Smithers station, the two of them, to get this bottle of whiskey. They stayed around for a few hours. Red Dutton was wearing a jacket from his New York Americans hockey team. And it was a spectacular jacket, brilliant colors, I can remember. I think blue and white with white, a lot of white stars on it. Very fancy jacket. And I think he gave that to Ken Warner, the editor of the Smithers paper. I presume Ken kept it because he never wore it outside, that I can recall. Anyway, they got their whiskey and they chugged back to Woodcock Airport on the speeder. It's quite a story. It's quite an incident. I was particularly struck by the fact that Red Dutton had run between stakes and hurdled the fences. I could just see him doing it. There was no wasting time with him. It was great. To conclude, I don't know if I really made it clear that the Department of Transport, we, the Department of Transport, did the runway, taxiway, apron construction. We looked after the construction of the residences for the radio operators and the terminal building or radio shack where they operated from. And I guess it was Department of National Defense did the engineering supervision for the Air Force buildings. I hope I have been able to supply a bit of information of value or interest to you. After all, it was nearly 50 years ago, or 50 years plus or minus 1 or 2 years, that all this happened. And things did happen quickly in those days. People didn't waste any time. None of the contractors wasted any time building. They were right at the job and got the job done quickly and well for the times. As I mentioned before, Peggy and Carl Spicer, if they're still around, are about the only two people I can think of who might be able to give you more information. I think after all, so many years have gone by, I can't think of any more to add to what I've already given. Hope it's of some use to you.